Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. You may have noticed that we've been releasing some additional episodes lately, often hosted by Livewire co-founder James Marlay. We hope you enjoy the additional content, and we'll be doing this more often. The interviews performed by James will be a little shorter than the usual podcasts, and will also be available as video interviews on the Livewire Markets YouTube channel, if you'd prefer to watch them. This week's guest on the podcast is Dr. Don Hampson, Managing Director at Plato Investment Management. Don has over 25 years of investment management experience and is one of five team members with a PhD at their aptly named firm. Don was formerly the Chief Investment Officer and Head of Equities at Westpac Investment Management. He was a finance lecturer at the University of Queensland, and he was a visiting assistant professor at the University of Michigan Business School. In today's episode, he'll discuss the outlook for equity income on the ASX, some overlooked Australian opportunities, and the single most expensive asset in the market today. Finally, if you're loving The Rules of Investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show.
Can you give me some background on why you started Plato? And why the name Plato? What's the correlation to what you do?
Well, I worked for a number of institutions before then, and groups like Westpac Investment Management and State Street, and you know, had some issues about not having a lot of control and responsibility, etc. And the offer came up to sort of start up my own boutique, and that's how Plato came about. Why the name Plato? Interesting name. I think a lot of fund managers call themselves after, you know, Greek gods or mythology or what have you, and you know, I think we'd like to be, you know, the thinking man's fund manager. So Plato's a great philosopher. He's a bit of a dabbled in mathematics as well. Set up the academy, etc. So, you know, we put a lot of research in, do a lot of work, and a lot of thinking behind how we invest money. And so I think, you know, Plato represents that. And we're very happy with the way that it's branded and what it means to investors.
And you have a PhD?
I do. In fact, half of our team members have PhDs. So, you know, we're all very well educated. So you think back again to Plato, it sort of started like virtually the first university or the academy. And, well, everybody's been to university in our team, but say five have gone on to do PhDs. Another one's actually of the 10 in the team. Another one's doing one now. So, we're all pretty well educated.
What's your PhD?
In finance, so we actually have three PhDs in finance. We got a PhD in mathematics and one in astrophysics, so we call him the rocket scientist.
So, you had the opportunity to start your own boutique, but your focus is specifically on equity income. Why particularly that niche or that specialty?
Yeah, well, it's something that I've had a fair bit of experience with. I mean, 20 years ago, I ran a somewhat similar fund at Westpac, the Tax Effective Share Fund. So, I mean, it's actually around income and tax and other things, but also we saw, a gap in the market, and a lot of people are still talking about it. You know, we need to build strategies for retirement, and we, you know, built this income strategy from the perspective of a retiree, because who needs income? Most retirees, they want to live off the income from their investments. So we structured a fund, you know, bottom up from a retiree's perspective, from a retiree's tax perspective, but also the fact that they need income to live off. And so if you can get a good consistent stream of income from a well-diversified portfolio. So it also marries in with some research that we've done, that there's some nice sort of, you know, not huge, but a little bit of outperformance in stocks around dividend ex dates. So, you know, stocks tend to outperform for a couple of months before they go ex-dividend. Yeah, it's not massive, but it's a little bit, and you know, you just need a bit of an edge in this game. So you marry that, these people want income, they get a bit of outperformance, it's quite tax effective for retirees, particularly people with superannuation funds, but also low income retirees. Then it's sort of a good product. And we actually won about 5 years ago an award for retirement product innovation. So, you know, we think it is a good product and, thinks about what the end investor does. I mean, I think the problem with a lot of fund managers is like, I'm a value manager, I'm a growth manager. And
it's all about really their style.
Yeah, that's their style. But they don't really think, what does the investor want? Does the investor want, you know, something that works well for, you know, part of the cycle, but not as well in other cycles? Do they want, you know, what do they want? And retirees want income. So if we can give them consistent levels of, you know, high income, and a well-diversified portfolio that, you know, we still, you know, sometimes we won't always outperform, but we've been pretty consistent in our performance. And, you know, these are retirees' money that probably they've stopped work, they can't really go back and save money. So they've got to live off this investment. So they want something that's also very well-diversified. So, you know, we build a portfolio which is quite unusual these days. I mean, now everyone's got the 20 stock portfolio, the 20 best bets, et cetera. We have a very well-diversified portfolio of like 100 stocks. But it's, you know, it's delivered consistency and it's got consistent income. So it's what the end investor wants.
Out of interest, what do you benchmark your performance against? If it's an income strategy, what's the right, is it the accumulation index or how do you measure yourself?
Yeah. So, and I think that's important as well. We actually have, well, two objectives. So they're both the same benchmark, which is the ASX 200. Our first objective is to deliver income because it is an income strategy. So our aim is to deliver more income after fees than what the index delivers. And we've ticked that box every year, generally by around 3%. So that's after fees. Then, but it's important that we also, because a lot of investors get the franking, we compare ourselves to a tax exempt version of that ASX 200 index, which includes franking credits. So the index is grossed up for franking and so is our performance. That's the first part, and that's people want the income, but it's also equity, it's equity income. So the equity component, if you put your money in equities, well, you know, you want to beat the market. And active managers hopefully should beat the market, you know, more than they on average over time. So we also have a second objective, which is actually to outperform the ASX 200 accumulation index, but including franking. So again, it's a tax exempt accumulation index. So
that's capital plus income. Franking.
Yeah, that's right. I'm happy to say that we've done that since inception as well after fees. So we're ticking both boxes. And. And I think that's what differentiates us from some of the other income strategies where it seems to be more about the income and less about the total return.
Yeah. There's been a lot of change in the domestic landscape. You know, we've had some uncertainty around what was going to happen with franking credits with the election. And we've also more recently had the Reserve Bank cutting rates. So some shifting dynamics in that would have, I think, an impact on the way that you were thinking about investing. Starting with the uncertainty around politics, there was discussion around companies wanting to release built-up franking reserves. And I know there were companies that, you know, particularly the miners paid out a lot of, you know, there were some special dividends. Now that there is certainty around franking credits, what impact or what change is that making for the companies where there are big reserves? Are you detecting any change in behaviour with how companies are planning on using any franking balances they might have?
Well, I think what's going to happen is we're going to go back to a more normal period. So last financial year, we've just gone through the financial year, quite a few companies actually paid out extra normal dividends, whether it was through buybacks or special dividends or what have you, and a number of them actually openly mentioned the franking credit issue and the potential that some clients, some investors, and it was only some, but some investors may miss out on that franking had they not paid it out. Now that we have an election result, and I think the franking issue is put to bed and it will still be here for quite a while, I don't think politicians will want to be, you know, pushing that, flying that flag up the flagpole again too quickly. Then I think companies will go back to a more normal situation. Having said that, I think it was actually quite a good thing some of these companies to flush out the franking, because it's only any good for the investors when they get the tax back from the government. So if a company's sitting on, you know, $1 or $2 or $3 billion worth of franking credits, it's not worth anything to the company, but it is worth it if it pays it out to investors. So I think there was a bit of a realisation from companies that actually shareholders value those and we should pay them out. Now, maybe that might change. Maybe companies might be a bit more upfront with their dividend policy. But I would expect companies to go back to a more normal level of dividends this financial year. Mm-hmm. We also had an unusual situation where the, you know, likes of Rio, BHP and Woolworths sold big assets, and so had a flush full of cash and franking credits, and so it was a nice opportunity to do that capital management, and that's not going to happen every year.
So does that mean you're dialing back your expectations about how much income can be generated from the equity market over the 12 to 24 months ahead of us?
Well, I think we're going back to a more normal year. I mean, we've just finished the year. We've just got the numbers through. Our fund will distribute over financial year 2018-19 16% gross income after fees, which is ridiculous. So it's gross including franking when the index is getting about 6. Now, the index doesn't count the buybacks and actually doesn't count the specials, or it does count the special franking credits, but doesn't count a special as a dividend. But nevertheless, the normal level of dividend in the market's about 6 and we delivered 16. So that is silly.
Abnormal.
That's abnormal. We would expect to go back to about 9% this financial year we're just heading into. We don't think companies are going to cut their dividends significantly, although there's always going to be the odd one that, you know, has tough times, etc. And we still see some very good dividends coming out of the resources sector, particularly the iron ore miners, where despite all the, you know, economists and pundits saying iron ore prices can't keep going up, they have kept going up and, you know, finished the financial year at a high. BHP, Rio and Fortescue are going to be very profitable, and they're not investing a lot of money back into their business, so we expect them to pay record dividends again this year. Probably not the buybacks, though.
Just in terms of the dividend landscape, the other part that I mentioned was the RBA cutting rates. Obviously, that when there's these high single and double digit yields available on the ASX, it makes it attractive. But if the Reserve Bank is cutting rates and they've done so twice, it suggests that everything is not looking all that rosy in the economy. From your analysis and looking at the companies that you're investing in, is there anything that gives you concern about the sustainability of those future earnings? A lot of the dividend yields that you can screen for are historic, and you know, I understand looking in the rearview mirror is probably not the best thing to be doing. When it comes to dividends, you want to be looking at the earnings going forward. So what are you seeing on that front, given the context of those rate cuts from the RBA?
Yeah, there's clearly some softness in the domestic economy and retail areas and those sorts of things. So, we'll be vigilant for what we call the dividend traps, because, if your stock's trading on an incredibly high yield, can either mean two things: they're incredibly profitable and they might keep going, or can also mean that their share price has fallen and it's a bit illusory and they're probably going to cut their dividend. So you need to be very cautious of that. So there is softness in a lot of domestic focused industries, but as I mentioned before, I think the dividends coming out of resources sector, particularly iron ore, will still be very, very strong. Banks, I think, will probably maintain, now that NAB's had its cut, will maintain reasonable yields. So I think the outlook's still pretty good, but you have to be cautious on some of those domestic stocks, because there are a few landmines out there where I think the earnings will disappoint and the dividends will probably be cut.
You talked about equity market. You're still taking equity market risk as an equity income manager. I had a look at PLA is an LIC, and I had a look at what was happening with the capital as well as the distributions with that fund, and then looked at an ETF that is purely looking to harvest income. And what you found was that there was a high yield, but over time there was quite a strong degradation of the capital value. What's the difference between what you're doing with your active fund and a dividend harvesting ETF, and why are you able to maintain that capital value?
Well, I think you've alluded to it before, which is you shouldn't chase yield looking in the rearview mirror. So the first rule is really not to use historic dividend yields as your selection criteria. And I think a lot of the ETFs around there basically say, I want to buy the stock trading on the highest yield, and that's basically the historic yield. And as I said, there's two ways for a company to become high yield. The first one is that it's actually very profitable and paying out a lot of money, which is what some of the resource stocks are doing at the moment. But the more common way often is that a stock comes on hard times, the share price collapses because dividend yield is simply dividends paid over the last 12 months divided by current price. If the current price is, you know, fallen 50 or 80%, you know, over the last 12 months, it's probably going to trade at a high yield if it paid a dividend in the last 12 months. And we try and avoid those, what we call dividend traps. And because if you just buy the absolute highest yielding stock, you'll probably come up with a couple of traps. And that means your capital is still at risk, and so you may lose money on that. So, you know, we have two objectives. The first one is income, but the second one is total return. And so whenever we enter a stock, we look at both of those objectives. Yes, we want decent income, but we may often steer away from the highest historic yield stocks because we're not, we're very concerned about the potential capital risk. Mm-hmm. And preservation of capital is important, particularly if you're managing money for retirees.
Do you think, you know, with the RBA lowering rates and forcing investors out of some of the more traditional income generating assets like term deposits, for example, has that created elevated risk in income generating or dividend paying stocks? Like, are you finding that as people get pushed out of things like bonds, as they go hunting for yield, that it's skewing the valuations of stocks and puts that capital component at greater risk?
It's certainly pushing up the prices of dividend paying stocks, that's for sure, and the whole market for that matter. And we've seen a strong rally in the market in the first half. I mean, including, you know, total return, the market's almost up 20% in the first half of this calendar year, which is pretty huge, especially given, you know, we had three worries at the start of the year, trade wars and slowing economy, and both of those are still around. The only one that's really changed has been the interest rate outlook, which we were worried about rising rates last year, and now we're worrying about falling rates. It has bid up the prices, which, you know, it does mean that, you know, in the very long term, if you buy an asset expensive, then it's, that's very important. We are value investors. But I think when you look at it relative across all assets, and that's the thing, is the expensive asset now is cash. I mean, actually, the numbers are very easy now that we have a 1% interest rate here in Australia as a cash rate. You don't normally think of PEs for debt instruments, but if you actually think about cash, if you're getting 1% on your overnight cash, you need to invest $100 to make $1. So your PE, the price you pay to get $1 of earnings is $100. Mm-hmm. So what's the expensive asset? The expensive asset is cash and bonds, and this 10-year bond yield is not much better. So to me, they're the very expensive assets. Equities actually haven't really fully factored in that. They've risen a bit because we've got a lower discount rate, but they haven't, I don't think, fully factored in those extremely low interest rates, because I think the market realises that rates will rise in the future. So I don't think the equity market's that stretched, given where interest rates are. In a relative sense, I think equities are actually cheap relative to cash and fixed income.
Mm. You said you thought that the markets could see rates rising in the future. That feels like something that's out for debate at the moment.
Well, let's put it this way. It looks like a long, long way away before that's likely to happen. I mean, given that we've only just had the first two rate cuts here, normally you have a cycle, and a cycle is usually longer than two. It's hard to see rates rising for a couple of years, to be honest. So I think that worry is now a few years out. All I think is that equity markets, have never really priced in the extremely low interest rates, because they do realise that between, central banks, whether it be quantitative easing at the long end or, cutting rates at the short end, have actually set interest rates artificially low because they want to stimulate the economy. Mm-hmm. They want people to actually go out and buy equities, and they want people to invest in risky assets. And, we suspect that investors will do that. There's still a lot of money, a huge amount of money in term deposits, but it's not getting you much income at the moment.
Just on that, going back to the idea of low interest rates pushing people into income generating stocks. Are there any, you know, you sort of said as an asset class, you still think equities look pretty attractive, but within that, underneath that heading, are there parts of the market that you know, where you feel like yields have been compressed too far, or anything that looks particularly risky to you at the moment?
Well, I think the risky part of them, riskiest part of the market, is actually the growth stocks. You know, what you call the waxes here or what have you. But, you know, there are a lot of stocks that actually don't make any earnings or very little earnings and don't pay dividends or very little dividends. And they've gone to, you know, those growth stocks have gone to ridiculous prices. So I think that is the end of the, you know, the market that I'd be particularly worried about. To me, the banks look pretty cheap, you know. Yeah, there's still a few risks around with them, etc. But I think by and large, they look pretty attractively priced still.
Yeah. Alrighty, I've asked you to bring along an idea or potentially an underappreciated income opportunity. Are you able to talk me through an example of a stock that you think is not well understood or that you think has a good earnings outlook and has that income component that you're able to share with us?
Well, you know, maybe it's starting to go through, and we've been saying this for a little while, but we still think the iron ore miners are actually, you know, aren't fully appreciated as income stocks. I think if you would ask the average person in the street where, you know, what's an income stock, they'd still probably say the banks or Telstra or what have you. And, you know, the yields that are coming off these guys this year, you know, you are talking like 8 to 10%, I reckon. And, you know, and it potentially can get better. So I think for a medium term, I think they're actually pretty good income stocks. And I think typical income managers or income people looking for income haven't really looked at that area.
It sounds like if a lot of the bad news is factored into the banks and the miners, which we know a lot of, you know, BHP, Rio, really big part of the index, and haven't traditionally been income paying stocks, it sounds like the opportunity to get some diversification from an income perspective, actually better than it may have been in the past.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, if you look historically, the banks and Telstra stood out as, you know, head and shoulders above the rest in terms of dividend yields, but now you've got it in another area that's pretty similar and very well diversified, benefiting from a lower Australian dollar. You know, if you look at iron ore prices in Australian dollar terms, they're getting back to the highs of, you know, 6-7 years ago. Mm-hmm. So they're not quite there in terms of US dollars, but in Australian dollars, actually, they're looking pretty solid. So, yeah, I think it's a good opportunity. But I would caution people that resources, you know, it is a cycle and these things can change quickly. So you need to be very aware of that. But for us, for the medium term, we're still pretty positive on those.
Yep. And Telstra is the other one that you named there. I know we spoke with one of your colleagues, Pete Gardner, at the end of last year. It was one of the companies that he was concerned about the sustainability of the dividends there. Is that still the view? It seems to have come through a bit of a rough patch.
Yeah, I mean, it's bounced back. I mean, it looks like, you know, there's not going to be a fourth mobile network anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And so that's assisted it. It has had a bit of a bounce. But I think, yes, the fact that it's still paying a special dividend is a signal to me to the market that there's potential that will cease. And if that's the case, then if you took its special out of the current yield of Telstra, it would have cut its dividend nearly 70% from 2 years ago. So, you know, the stock has pulled back strongly this year, but still over the medium term, we're not overly positive. We think there's still some hurdles ahead for it.
Mm-hmm. Don, if you were to go back and give yourself some advice or to someone that was just starting out, particularly with that income hat on, what are some of the pieces of advice or rules that you would give to someone from an investment perspective?
Well, sort of, I think one key one is, you know, be aware of dividend traps. I mean, it said it already, but I think that's very important is if don't necessarily always focus on the highest yielding stocks, because it can either be a solid stock, like at the moment, you know, I think the banks and the resource stocks probably on pretty good yields actually and maintainable for the foreseeable future. But you know, it's very easy to look at a stock and it's trading at 18% yield, and you know, it's one that we haven't talked about, but it is in the resource sector, like Alumina. It's actually trading on 18% yield at the moment, and that looks incredible. And you know, we have talked up the resources, but interesting there, aluminium and alumina, and the price of those have come back. So we actually expect that one to probably reduce and trim its dividends. So, you know, don't get sucked in by that incredible high yield, because, you know, it's risk and return. And something that's trading on a 15 or 20% yield, you know, gross yield, that's suggesting that there's got to be some element of risk about it, or cyclical risk, or longer term risk.
Thanks for coming and having a chat. Obviously, an interesting and I would suspect quite a good time to be an equity income investor. So thanks for coming in and sharing a few of your ideas with us today.
Thank you.